Hey everyone, welcome to the Unhandled Exception podcast. I'm Dan Clark and this is episode number 48. So we're getting very close to 50 episodes, which is quite exciting. And today I'm joined by Isaac Levin. And rather than talk about a particular topic, we've decided we're just going to chat and geek out and see where the conversation takes us. So welcome to the show, Isaac. It's great to have you on.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. I'm quite thrilled to be speaking with you.
I think it's going to be quite a fun conversation. So could you just give the listeners a quick introduction to who you are and what you do and what you enjoy doing?
Sure, I'll give the abridged version. So I'm Isaac Levin. Most people probably know me on the web social tech space in the .NET community. So I've been a .NET developer for my entire professional career, and I've kind of wore a bunch of different hats. You know, I've been a typical back office line of business application developer in ranked things in .NET and C#. And I've been a consultant, and I've been in product marketing, and now my latest foray is into developer advocacy, where I currently am a .NET developer advocate at AWS.
That's cool. I'm really looking forward to digging into that in a bit. But before we do and start chatting code, technology and stuff, I'm just going to quickly do this episode's listener mention. And this one goes to Suraj Kanchura, who tweeted the screenshot of his Spotify Wrapped top three podcasts this year. And the three were Hanselman It by Scott Hanselman, the Waveform podcast, which I've not actually listened to, but looking at their list, it looks pretty good. And this podcast. So he said, these are the only podcasts I listen to, and I suggest others do too. So thanks, Waveform, Scott, and Dan, for sharing such interesting, varied, and valuable content this whole year. That actually really made my day, and it was an honour to be included alongside Mr. Scott Hanselman, which was quite amazing. I believe you've actually spoken to him recently. I was listening to that episode on your podcast.
Yeah, no, so we can talk about my podcast in a second, but I just want to just call out like the fact that you're mentioned at the same level as Marcus Brownlee, who's like probably the most influential tech person on the planet, and then Scott Hanselman, who obviously in the .NET space is, in the technology space in general, is a pioneer as well. Like, that's quite good company, Dan. So I think you need to be a bit more braggatory as it pertains to that. Like, you should definitely be leaning on that. Put on your website. Put it everywhere that you see. Top three podcasts for this individual, along with Scott Hanselman and Marcus Brownlee. So that's great. Kudos for you.
Thank you. I can't do bragging. I'm not very good at that. It was quite an honor.
Is that because you're from the UK? You're so modest because you're from the UK? Yeah.
Maybe. I've not got my tea here, actually, my cup of tea. Oh, actually, speaking about beverages, I know the logo on your podcast is like quite a big coffee machine, so
yeah,
we definitely need to talk about that. I saw a Chris Sainty, who does a lot on Blazor, you probably know him.
Yep.
He tweeted a week or so ago, he'd done some coffee art.
Oh, cool.
He made a coffee with his coffee machine, done some coffee art, and he'd taken a photo of his coffee he'd made, and in the thread he had said what coffee machine he had. So I googled it, and I definitely got coffee envy. I think when I next remortgage my house, I might buy it.
Yeah, I've never gone the route of having like the proper coffee machine with the espresso and the frothing. I've never done that. I'm a pretty boring, just drip coffee machine sort of person. If I can just be completely honest, I'm not a huge fan of all the different iterations of coffee. I like coffee because only iced coffee, though, for whatever reason. I don't like hot drinks. But I just like, and it's not the energetic part of it. It's just like, there is something soothing about drinking a cup of coffee. And obviously, you know, that kind of leads into like the podcast thing. Like, I just think the phrase, so my podcast is called Coffee and Open Source. And I think that the name just goes very well together. I used to at least try to like talk a little bit about coffee at the beginning, but I realized like some guests don't drink coffee. Like you mentioned, like Scott Hanselman has been on my show. Scott Hanselman is very much a Diet Coke only person. So like he's like, you should have changed it to Diet Coke and open source. I'm like, oh, I missed an opportunity to do that. But yeah, it's quite funny. Like, some people are very serious about their coffee. I'm not quite that serious.
Yeah, I did like on that episode, I think, because I was listening to it in the audio, and I think you do video as well, which we can talk about. So I wasn't actually seeing the visual, but sure. I think you were talking about a green screen and he was suggesting changing the background to be Diet Coke or something.
Yeah, so that particular episode was funny because I had, so for the folks who haven't seen or listened to my podcast, I live stream it on Twitch. So, and this is why I have a video recording of it. And then I obviously do some audio processing for the audio version that goes out to all the different podcast clients. But for the video, like, so I was having an issue with my lighting in my office. So I used to have a green screen behind me, and the green screen was just basically, you know, allowed me to put a logo or whatever. And I was having issues. So the green screen just completely got messed up. And Scott, thinking that hilarious, you know, mentioned a couple of things. He brought out his green screen. He set it up and changed his background. And it looked great because Scott has a great setup. And it was just quite funny. So if folks do like listening to Scott Hanselman make fun of people, definitely take a look at that podcast. It's available on YouTube at Coffee and Open Source. You can search for that on YouTube. Yeah, it was fun. Like, always talking to Scott is a good time. Talking to people in general about tech is great. And I don't know if you have a similar feeling as somebody who does a podcast, but I do it solely for myself, just getting to have conversation with people that I typically wouldn't get a chance to chat to, right? Like, I've interviewed Kelsey Hightower. I interviewed Liz Fong Jones, who works at Honeycomb. I've interviewed, obviously, Scott Hanselman, Martin Woodward. I've interviewed people that I would literally never have a chance to talk to unless I convince them to do a podcast interview, right? So it's just a great opportunity for me to really build my own thoughts about things. Like, I don't know if you feel the same way. Like, I have a huge bias for a lot of things. And how I see it is, the more people I talk to that have different backgrounds as me, I have an opportunity to change as an individual, whether it be professionally or personally. And that's the reason why I do the podcast. I don't do it for money. I don't do it for fame. I literally do it for myself. And the only thing that I tell people is, at the end of the show, when I say it's been an hour and their response is, oh, that was quick, I had a lot of fun, that's the only thing that I hope for, right? Because again, I'm not in it for anything other than me having a great time and the person that I'm interviewing have a great time.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm kind of exactly the same. I do it because I love geeking out with people and just chatting technology, and I enjoy that. I've been really looking forward to this because I just enjoy chatting, and it's why not record it? I think for many, many years, I've been an avid podcast listener. I think hearing the passion that hosts and guests have on podcasts over the years is what's made me more passionate about software development now, because it's kind of contagious, isn't it? And I've been thinking about starting a podcast for quite a while. And then when COVID hit, so there was lockdown, I knew I'd be working from home for quite a long time to come, and I'd be talking with work all day long. I invested in a decent kit, and I thought, well, this is the perfect opportunity to do so. And it was the end of lockdown where I started it. But I'd had that year of working from home where my job was just talking tech as part of work over Teams and screen sharing. So I kind of like got a bit of practice just through work naturally by talking tech. And then I decided to go for it. And yeah, it's been fantastic. And as you say, I've spoken to people I never would have spoken to.
Yeah. It's funny, isn't it, that like, and this isn't in any way to kind of talk about the pandemic in a positive light, but the one thing that it did do is it forced a lot of people to think a bit differently about, you know, working from home. You know, that includes having at times a good video and audio setup. So you feel even more connected to the person that you're talking to, right? Because we can't physically see each other, physically touch each other, whatever, right? So having the most high fidelity camera, or a high fidelity camera and a high fidelity microphone, it helps that experience. And I think, and this is kind of what you were saying, like the outcome of that is that now everybody has like a setup that you can definitely do a podcast. Because I have thought about doing a podcast or other things like a few years ago too. And it's like, oh, I don't want to invest in a really nice microphone, like, because I'm working out of the office. I don't want to invest in a good webcam. But now, like, I have those things because I needed them. So now I might as well make use of them in another way, which I think is really valuable.
Yeah, I think before I got used to working from home, the idea of talking into a microphone would have, I don't want to say terrified me, but sure. I just got used to it because everyone did. So going back to this Scott Hanselman episode again, one thing that I found quite interesting is where you asked Scott how much things had changed, like working remotely, and he had said he's done it forever anyway. And I guess when I heard that, the thing I thought was, well, it must have, the fact that everyone else was remote as well must have made a massive difference. And as you say, everyone's getting the gear, or maybe not to this level, but actually getting used to talking through microphones and webcams, and it just changes our whole industry, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that there's one thing to call out, too, that's really important. I don't know if it was Scott who mentioned this first or somebody else, but there's a huge difference between remote work and pandemic work, right? So when March of 2020 came around and everybody started to have to work from home, their experience is a bit differently than folks that have been working remotely for a long time. Like, I used to work remote too. And funny enough, like I took a job that required me to be in an office, and I literally had that job in an office for like 3 or 4 months. And then I was working remotely again. So I understood what it meant to work from home. But I think the biggest thing is being forced to work from home and choosing to work from home are two completely different ways of experiencing things, right? In tech in general, we have a bit of bias because usually we enjoy like buying tech things. So we want to go and research the best webcam or the best audio or find the mixer that we want or a green screen, or we have, you know, we have enough money that we can have a house that we have a dedicated space. And then one of the things that I've tried to do, especially in the last few years, is build empathy for folks that don't want that, right? Like, there are a ton of people that were forced to work from home in their closet, on their kitchen table, whatever, right? And I think that experience isn't great. So I could definitely understand why some people wouldn't want to work from home, because their home situation or for whatever reason, they don't want to be there. They'd rather go into an office and get that experience of being in an office, which is great. Me personally, I love working from home because I don't have a commute. I can hang out with my family a little bit more. I have a dedicated space where I can kind of nest and build like something that makes me comfortable. But not everybody has that luxury, right? And I think it's really, really important to think about that. It's like, okay, well, working from home is really great, but it's not for everybody. It's funny enough because I used to do a talk like pre-pandemic at events where I think the name of the talk was Working from Home is Not for Everybody or something like that. And it was just an hour-long conversation about the pros of working from home and the cons of working from home and things that you could, I guess, do better from home in some scenarios and some things that just don't work very well at all. And it was always a great conversation. And funny enough, like, the pandemic hit, and then I think a lot of the things that I talked about in that talk became quite relevant for a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the key things you touched on there was, like, not everyone can afford to. And I think we talk about having a dedicated room in the house that we could then make an office. That is a very privileged thing to say, that I've got this room that I can just have as my office moving forward because I've decided I'm going to start working from home. A lot of people will be on a laptop on the sofa with the laptop on the knee. And if you think about doing that all day, like the back aches, like head leaning forward. So we are very privileged and lucky. And I think it's important that if you're in that situation, you remember that.
Yeah, I think even in general, like here's something that I found quite interesting, right? So I had a colleague, this is when I was working at Microsoft at the time. So I used to work at Microsoft for a few years. And like I had a colleague, and both her and her husband worked from home. And there was one office. So I'm guessing some conversation they had about who got the office or whatever, because she was always taking calls from the kitchen table or calls from the office or whatever. And I think that that just introduces a interesting wrinkle to a relationship, right? Like, oh, I need the office. My job is more important than yours is. Not saying that specifically, but it's hard to negotiate something like that. Like, as two people working from the same house and they don't have enough space to do it, you know, that could be taxing on a relationship, right? So that's like another additional wrinkle that not a lot of people really thought about. Because if you had a family where both people work from home and there's not one office, like, it's very weird. And I don't know if you've experienced this, but like being in a room and having somebody else in another room on a call and you can hear it, it's if it's at your house, it's different than like in an office building, right? So it is definitely very interesting, but I'm glad that now people have options. Like, if they want to go back into an office, if their employer is allowing it, they have that flexibility if they want it. If they want to stay at home, people can do that as well. I think the worst thing that could happen is everybody being forced to do something they don't want to do, or if they don't have the luxuries of some of the things we talked about. It's it's challenging, but I'm glad that, I'm not saying COVID is over, but I'm glad that we've gone to a point where the majority of people have vaccines, the majority of people are being safe, and we're coming back to some sense of normalcy. I don't think we'll ever actually be normal. I think COVID is going to be around forever. But now we have some mechanisms to, I guess, return to some sense of what it was before this time.
Definitely. I hate saying about COVID having a silver lining because a lot of people, it was absolutely awful. And so if, I feel guilty saying this, but it has for our industry. And I guess there's other things as well, like with the mRNA research that came out of that. And now they're finding vaccines for lots of other stuff as well. So it's made a massive impact to medicine as well.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. I think it is hard to say there's a silver lining in things, but I think, you know, the worst thing that we can do is always play the victim or always think about things from a negative light. Like, I'm a natural pessimist, so I always think about things negatively. So it's really one of the things that I'm looking to do in my life is just try to be more optimistic about things. And yeah, to your point, like the amount of research that's been done in this space to combat not just COVID or those sort of respiratory illnesses, but all illnesses using this mRNA concept, right? Like, if we can get to a point where we can solve a lot of the overarching diseases that really cause problems with the human population, like, that's a good thing. If we had the opportunity to do these things before, we would have. But I don't think we were given that opportunity. We were forced to create this sort of, I guess, I don't know if it's technology or what you would phrase it, sort of medicine. We were forced to do it because literally people were, you know, quite frankly, people were dying at a clip that was just unsustainable. So we had to do something like this. And we got all of the funding and the escalation of different things. And now we've gotten to a point where we can take these learnings that we've had and put them to other things that we could tackle, which is great. And yeah, it is a silver lining. I mean, it's a shitty thing, like thinking about it, right? But I think in general, if we can do better and have a better experience in the long term, it's somewhat worth it, right?
Yeah, it's a difficult one because it depends who hearing the conversation would have different opinions of what's worth,
oh, yeah.
I guess. But it's always a very tricky topic to approach. So keeping with this people theme, going back to your podcast, one thing I quite like about it is that if you look at my list of episodes, it's very topic, gRPC, Vim,
sure,
.NET 7 or whatever the topics are. So it's that with guest name, where all yours are just guest name. It's very much about the people. And I quite like that, actually. Just it's not topic. It's like each subject is just a person's name.
Yeah, I think, and part of the reason why I do that is, one, I think the idea of interviewing people with a list of questions and you have a particular agenda from it, I don't enjoy sort of conversations like that. And that's why, you know, not to plug your podcast on your podcast, but like that's the reason why I like your podcast, is that there isn't like a, hey, here's a list of 60 questions that we're going to ask, right? And the reason why I tend to go towards like the people side of things is I've had conversations with people that I literally know nothing about what they work with, right? So like I've interviewed people who are on the language design team for Go. I've interviewed people that, you know, I interviewed Joe Beda, who was one of the founders of Kubernetes, right? Like I can't have a conversation about Kubernetes with somebody like that because I'm going to sound like an idiot. But what I can do is I can talk about the things that they think about when they think about tech. And my thing is, like, we all have passions, right? Like, if you're passionate enough to spend a career in tech and a career influencing tech or the community of tech, you're very passionate about, and your passion will shine through. We could talk about literally anything. And if any of your listeners have listened to my show, there's general themes that we've had in every single episode. And it's always about, you know, how we can do better in tech, how we could be more diverse in tech, more inclusive in tech. Because those are the sort of things that I have interest in, because I think in general, we create these echo chambers in tech. And good, bad, or indifferent, we don't get very many opportunities to leave our echo chamber. But the thing is that even though outside of our echo chambers, we still have a lot of things in common. And that's the thing that's really interesting to me, is like building these relationships with people. Because, like, look, you and I both love .NET, for instance, right? but there's people who don't care about .NET. There are some people that hate .NET. That doesn't mean that I can't have a conversation with them. It sometimes can be a bit harder, but it doesn't mean that we can't find something to talk about for an hour with no problems, right?
Yeah, definitely. So if I actually think back in my career, I can think of like various different things that happened which kind of made me get a bit more out of my comfort zone, but incrementally. Yeah. And without those things, there's no way I would have had the confidence to start a podcast.
Sure.
That obviously you run a podcast as well. And I'd be like quite interested to hear more about your background and if there was any of those key things that you did which kind of helped grow your comfort zone and get you to the point where you are now.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of like catalyst times in my career that I think about a lot. You know, I think one that comes to mind a lot, especially recently, and I have no idea why, is earlier in my career, I've always been a person that has, I guess, learned things quickly, right? Like, and that's, I mean, that's not, it. I'm not the best developer, but I pick things up pretty quickly so I can solve problems pretty fast. That's led me to be somewhat lazy, I think. But regardless of that, I think one of the things that I think about a lot is that I was working at a job a long time ago now, and I was the youngest person on my team, but because of the fact that I could get stuff done, I kind of had turned into like a somewhat of a, okay, Isaac, we can just give Isaac this work and Isaac will do it. So I was given a kind of a high profile task that I needed to do. And let's just say that it didn't go the way that I'd wanted. And it basically involved me deleting a bunch of records from a production database. And, you know, I remember after it happened, like we got all the data back. There was backups and everything. Nothing was really fine. There was like an hour window where things were not very great, right? So afterwards, I had a conversation with my manager and he was like, look, you've had like, this is a great learning experience for you. Like a very positive sort of conversation. And it's like, you know, I think we all can learn something from this, right? And I was like, okay, cool. That's great. And then 2 days later, he brought me to his office and they fired me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Because of that?
Because of that, yeah. Because the CEO of the company found out about it and said somebody needs to get fired for this. And I think what I took from that was, oh, well, it really doesn't matter what we do. There's always something that we have no control over. And I remember, like, at the time, I was engaged to be married. We were paying for the wedding ourselves. And I texted my wife on my way home. I was like, I just got fired. And she's panicking, obviously, because she's getting married in a few months and I don't have a job now. So I go home and the first thing I do is I give her a hug and I say everything's gonna be okay. And then I go and I start filling out job applications like immediately. And I had a job like within a week, less than a week. It wasn't like my ideal job, but it made sure that we still had a stream of money to be able to do things that we wanted to do. And I think at that point in time, I use this phrase falling face up a lot. Basically, like if you fall down, like if you're, you know, buttering toast or making a sandwich and you drop the bread, if it falls face up and the wet part isn't on the ground, life's great, right? If it lands face down, like, oh, that's probably not the best thing to eat, depending on where it lands, obviously. But if it falls face up, you have an opportunity to eat that sandwich or eat that piece of bread without feeling kind of gross about yourself. So I use the phrase falling face up because if we have the opportunity, if we fail, that's an opportunity for us to learn from that failure. And if we can fall face up and learn something from it and then continue about our lives, it gives ourselves an opportunity to learn from our mistakes and grow as an individual. So I think from my perspective, like that's the biggest thing that I've taken out of something like that, right? Like I got fired and the first thing that I did is I went and got a new job immediately. I didn't sit there and be sad or whatever. So that's one thing that I think about a lot about, oh, like if I would have just been a bit more negative and just, you know, sit around the house or whatever, like people get fired all the time and they decide to kind of sit in their own sadness. I didn't want to do that. And I think the fact that I was able to just rebound fairly quickly, looking back at it, it's like, oh, that's a very adult thing to do. And I wasn't very old at the time. Like I was engaged to be married, but I was in my, you know, mid-20s. So it wasn't something that I look back, I'm like, oh, that's a pretty adult thing for someone to do. So that's one example of something that's happened in my career or my life where I'm like, oh, like that's definitely a moment where you learn a bit about yourself and you kind of had an idea about things that are interesting or things that are important to you. I have other origin stories too about other things, but you know, we can chat about that example if you like a little bit.
Yeah, I found it quite interesting when you said about they've fired you because you deleted some records in a database. And it reminded me of a recent episode with Iris Klassen, where we were talking about her book, The Copy and Paste Developer. We had a very similar conversation about making mistakes as a developer. And a point that was raised was that you shouldn't be able to do that in production.
Sure.
Because they should have policies around. You should have like security policies that, especially it sounds like you were a junior developer at that point, shouldn't be able to accidentally delete records in production. So is that your fault or is that the company's fault?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more nuance to this story that I didn't really talk about, but let's just say that we had gone through multiple iterations of testing in other environments, and let's just say that for whatever reason, the implementation that we created that worked in a bunch of other environments didn't work in production. So it was something that literally, you know, had multiple people sign off on, was tested pretty thoroughly, and it just didn't happen to work out the way you wanted to in production. And since I was kind of the main person on it, I assumed that there was some decision to, okay, well, we should have this person pay the tax for it. But yeah, I totally agree with your point about, like, you know, production data is specifically is of the utmost importance to a business. And if you introduce an opportunity in any facility to tarnish or damage that asset that you have, it's a flaw in the system, right? Mistakes happen, and that's why we do backups and all these sort of things. But at the end of the day, there needs to be a pretty substantial level of investigation into any change to production, right? But at the same time, look, we're developers. Moving things to production for us should be very easy. Oh, it's just a publish command or whatever, right? But it's not as simple as that. And I know that, you know, things like DevOps tools and other methods make things like substantially easy, like from a physical perspective to get things there. But there's all these other topics that we need to consider. Like, is this going to affect things? Are we going to create regressions, whatever? And I think from a technical standpoint, like, we rush too much to let's just use the tool to get into production without really thinking about what does that actually mean for the business.
Yeah, I guess also you mentioned about DevOps tools and things. Back then, probably the standard was to drag and drop and copy and paste stuff. I suppose that those are the binaries, but then data is something else because you've got to think about breaking changes. So data is much, much harder. It's one of those things where things like that do happen, but the outcome of that should be, how do we stop it from happening again? Not who do we fire? So,
yeah. I mean, I made out pretty well. Like, I'm not, like, I always think about, like, oh, if that didn't happen and I stayed there, like, what would my life be like right now? Like, I always kind of think about stuff like that. And I think in general, like, I'd still have gravitated towards what I'm doing right now. One story that's also interesting is, you know, for a long time in my career, I was, people in tech say I was a dark matter developer, I was a back office developer. Like, I was a consumer of technology, not really somebody who was an advocate for it or a community member. And I was totally fine with that. Like, I was making good money, I was doing interesting things, but I wasn't really giving anything back, right? And I remember I was working at a company, I had the opportunity to go to the Build conference, and I ran into a friend of mine who, you know, they become a Microsoft MVP, they were considering joining Microsoft, and we used to work together, and we had gone two different ways, and he had been gone more into the traditional, like, oh, I'm a .NET developer, community champion, and all that sort of stuff, and I went kind of a different way. And I remember him talking about how much he was getting out of it and how passionate he felt about tech. And I kind of had this epiphany. It's like, why can't I do that? Like, I love having conversation with people. I love, you know, working with junior developers and these sort of things. I should do that. So I started contributing to, you know, Microsoft Docs in the C# space. And, you know, that led me into wanting to do public speaking. And then that led me into doing all sorts of other things. And, you know, fast forward a few years, and now I talk about .NET for a living. Like, it's pretty crazy to think about. Like, I don't write a lot of code. I write a lot of demo code, but I don't like ship stuff. It's only .NET. It's very interesting to think about because I could have just stayed building back office line of business applications and been totally fine probably. But I went down this career path instead where now, like, I guess my brand, not to say that I have a huge brand, but my personality, my brand is the most important part of what I do, not being able to write code.
Yeah, definitely. Although I think I would, if I wasn't writing code at all, I would quite miss that.
Sure.
I've recently been doing some Azure BTC stuff where it's been, oh, the custom policies there is XML. So I've been coding in XML and that's horrible. And then, so I was doing that for a chunk of time. And then I went to doing, actually write some .NET code. And it was like, oh, this is amazing. I feel like good again. I can write some .NET code. And I would also miss if I was just doing that and not doing any kind of, because I'm a consultant, so I'm kind of doing code. I'm lucky that I'm doing coding, but I also speak with a client, like do mentoring and that kind of thing. And I would miss that side of it too.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that one of the things that, you know, everybody has their own levels of interest, right? Like I think me specifically, like the thing that I enjoy the most is speaking with other .NET developers in general. That's why I do a podcast. That's why I love to go and speak at events. That's why I like to do meetups. That's the part of the job that I like. The writing code part, it fulfills a need for sure, but it's very much a conduit for this other thing that I have more interest in, right? Like if I stopped writing .NET code and then a few years, like I'm still like showing on stage, like how to do things in like, you know, web forms. No one would want to see my talks, right? I have this responsibility to pay attention to what's new, make sure that I understand it, be able to write code that shows the new things. And it's all to be able to, I guess, be more accessible way for the developer community. Because not everybody has the luxury to go in and look at the ASP.NET Core repo and like follow along what's going on. Or be on Twitter and see like, you know, what the .NET team, like what they're tweeting out and some of the cool concepts that they're building, right? I could be a more accessible way to get that content to folks, right? Not to say that people should only pay attention to me and not pay attention to other folks, but like I have conversation with people all the time. And this is something funny with, you know, I currently work at AWS, right? So I talk with AWS customers and not a lot of AWS customers are aware that .NET runs on Linux, right? And that's like been like around for 5 years, 5+ years, right? And it's not that they're not like they don't care. It's just that they haven't been paying attention because they've been busy with their job. So if I can get to folks and help them with some of these more foundational things, like .NET is substantially different now, right? Like I think that I can provide value in that space. So that's why I do it.
Interesting. You say a lot of AWS people don't know that .NET runs on Linux. I would hazard a bet that a lot of .NET developers don't know that .NET runs on Linux.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying particularly because most of the people that I talk to are either random people that have come to a .NET conference, whatever, or people that are AWS customers and they build .NET apps. But yeah, I mean, it's always shocking to me. It happens more than not. Like you talk to somebody, oh, you're a .NET developer. Like, what's the coolest thing you're working on? Oh, I mean, I maintain a .NET 3.5 application. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, have you been paying attention to .NET? No. And that's fine. Like, if you want .NET to be your day job and then you can go home and work on cars or woodwork or whatever, and that's where your interest lies, cool. Go for it. I'm not like that. Technology is my hobby. So it's hard for me to wrap my head around the idea of somebody not paying attention, right? But I understand that I'm a bit different than a lot of other folks in that regard.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that, what was the term you mentioned before about being in a bubble?
Echo chamber,
yeah. And that's kind of, I feel like we're almost in an echo chamber where we're on looking on Twitter, social media, we're reading up on like the latest what's new in .NET or whatever technology it is, we're keeping up to date. So we kind of like just know what's coming way before it's even come, mm-hmm. especially now things are open source. But most developers just don't do that, as you said. In fact, it's interesting just thinking back. So I'm going back again to your chat with Scott Hanselman, but one thing I found quite interesting is where he said that you were talking about when he first got into programming. And at that point, programming wasn't as lucrative as it is now.
Yeah.
And yeah. So it's kind of where, so a lot of people now are getting into it because of the money, where back then people were getting into it because they love tech and like programming, yes, and like that kind of stuff. So the ratio now of developers that are passionate is probably a lot less out of everyone. Obviously, there's a lot more developers though.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's a really good point, right? Like, you know, there was a point in time where tech wasn't a way to make money. I think obviously like in the late 90s, that probably changed substantially. I think one thing that's also very interesting in general about this whole idea of why people get into tech, right? It's interesting because you talk, and I don't know if you talk to a lot of people that aren't in tech and they're trying to get into tech, but I do it occasionally just because it's an area of interest for me. And the first thing I tell people is like, it's not an easy job. It might seem easy if you pay attention to the people that are very good at it, right? Good being a very arbitrary word. There's a lot of pain in technology. Like I jokingly tell people like, you know, it's worth like 95% of pain is worth 5% of pleasure, right? You're writing an app and it's build errors and compile errors and random things not working. And then when it works, like you literally like it's a euphoric moment, right? And I tell people you have to be a little bit of a masochist to enjoy being in tech because it's not easy. And you have to be patient and you have to be willing to deal with obstacles all the time. Not even just technical things, like business related things. You know, to go back to our conversation about like not being able to use the latest technologies, right? Like you have a lot of things that could be challenging. And I think that's one of the things that I try to tell people, like, don't be discouraged if you get started in tech and you're not enjoying it. Because I've been in tech for 15 years and there's days where I can't stand it. I jokingly tell my wife, like, maybe I should, you know, quit and do something else. Right. And then she's like, no, you'd be miserable. And I'm like, yeah, you're probably right. But I would be so frustrated at the time. Right. Because I had a colleague right when I got out of college and it was my first job. And this person, they've been published by O'Reilly, a brilliant .NET developer. And I remember them looking at one line of code for like 5 days. And they couldn't figure out why they couldn't get this little section of code to work the way they wanted to. And I remember when they finally figured it out, they literally just screamed really loud. Like, and I wish that I would have had some understanding of why that was so important at the time, but I was new and I didn't really get it. But now thinking back about that, I'm like, oh, that must've felt so good. It must've felt so good.
I think it's important that newer developers realize that this doesn't change if people are trying to get into it. If you've been doing it for 20 years, this is still your day to day. And just yesterday I was pairing with someone and something worked first time and there was that euphoriotic way. No way. There's no way that worked first time. And things don't.
No.
And our industry, you've got to know how to learn. Like you mentioned, you're a fast learner. It's so important in our industry to be able to teach yourself and not rely on others. There's so much stuff online that you can do that, but not everyone is willing to do that.
Oh, sure. I think, you know, tools like Stack Overflow or GitHub Copilot or Code Whisperer or IntelliCode or IntelliSense, like these tools are great, but they introduce a very interesting problem. If I'm not writing the code myself, do I trust whatever the code is that's being run, right? I'm very guilty of it myself. Like I'll go to Stack Overflow or whatever, and I'll just copy and paste like a huge chunk of code and then be pissed off that it's not working the way I want it to, right? And I think it's my responsibility to know what that code is doing. But like I mentioned a bit earlier, like I at times can be very lazy. And it's funny that like I want to just do this thing that's lazy, but then I want to complain or be upset when the lazy thing backfires miserably, right? So that's something too, like the tools are helpful, but the tools also introduce a whole new set of problems, right? I mean, I jokingly say like I have to Google how to do a group by with link every time I do it. Like my brain goes in there, it goes out the other ear, right? There's some things that I'll never be able to remember. Like the fact that I don't know very many people that don't use these tools. I remember I had a professor in college. They gave us a programming assignment. I think they gave us a week to do the assignment. And I asked him, like, how long would it take for you to write this? And he's like, as long as it took me to type it. And I was like, okay, that seems very sus to me. You mean you're not going to like look up how to do anything? Like, how do you reference a tail pointer for something? Like, this was in like Ada, the programming language. You mean to tell me you know how to do all this stuff without looking at one thing? And he said, yeah. I'm like, okay, well, I guess you're brilliant, I guess. I mean, that is something that my brain, I can't even fathom being able to do something like that.
I guess times have changed as well, because if you're working with one programming language and you're doing something like pointer or something like that, then I can understand that being. But nowadays, we use that many different libraries and tools and frameworks and stuff. I don't think anyone can remember all of those things. So you've always got to resort to Google and Stack Overflow and that kind of thing at some point. One thing I'm quite looking forward to, which I'll include a link to the show notes, is in January, you're actually joining us to do a talk at Donut Oxford in person, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, I am quite excited. Yeah, I think I mentioned this a bit earlier. Like, one of the things that I love to do is I love to just hobnob it with the developer community, right? And talk about tech and these sort of things. And, you know, like you mentioned, like, I'm going to be in the UK because AWS, we're sponsoring NDC London. So I'm going there and I'm going to work at the booth and have conversation with Donut developers. And I presented at another meetup, and I was having a conversation with the organizer for that meetup. And I said, would you be interested or know anybody that'd be interested in having me present while I'm in town? And they connected me with you, and you were thrilled, and I'm thrilled too. And it's going to be great. Like, I really enjoy speaking to developers, especially in person. And the chances of me speaking at .NET Oxford are like 0%, right? And I think that this is like a rounding error, being able to do this. Like, I happen to be there at a particular point in time where you have an opening in your schedule. Like, this is great. Like, so I'm looking forward to it. So, I mean, if you're in the south of England, come to .NET Oxford at the end of January, because I'll be there.
I'm so looking forward to that, because going back to the lockdown and COVID and stuff, we've been mostly virtual since then. I had monthly meetups, but they've been virtual. And we've had one in-person one, I think, and that was like a lightning talk event. And it was just amazing, everyone being in person again. And because obviously we're a community, we've been going for like 5-6 years now. So the group of people where the people that always go, and then we always go to the pub afterwards. So just reconnecting with those people was amazing. So I'm so looking forward to January as well. And you're doing a talk on updating old .NET framework apps, which is kind of relevant to what we're talking about before, which is quite interesting.
Sure.
I think you were going to, one of your potential talks was, you mentioned AWS was doing, but I think you've recently done it somewhere else. So we said to do this other talk. But going back to AWS, because I've done a lot of Azure stuff, but and I really should, I need to play with AWS, but I just happen to have not done much with AWS.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think, you know, especially if you're somebody who's built apps on Azure, right? You understand how the Azure portal works. You understand a lot of the concepts of Azure. There are similar concepts in AWS, but AWS does things a bit differently, and that's okay. Like, AWS very much goes by this least privileged model as it pertains to like having access to databases or access to S3 buckets. You can configure them at the app level. Sort of like if you were to use like an Azure, like, you know, RBAC, like role-based access, that is the way to do things at AWS. Like, you don't have other alternatives unless you work really hard. Also, there's this idea in the AWS world of, we want to always be coupling infrastructure with our apps. So like, we have things like the Cloud Developer Kit or CDK, which is like, hey, define my entire infrastructure and my app and deploy them up at the same time. So like, those are sort of some of the things that are different. But like, from a nuts and bolts, like, hey, I want to host my app in a VM, or I want to host my app in a container or in a serverless offering, like, it's the same between all of the clouds, right? I think the one thing that's the most interesting to me is like the developer tooling, right? Like, I talk to people and it's like, oh, like, we have a really great Visual Studio extension for AWS and a VS Code extension for AWS and a JetBrains Writer one for AWS. And we have command line tools that allow you to deploy stuff. And if you talk to .NET developers, mostly they aren't aware of these things. And I try not to like say, oh, this is a better experience than this, because I don't think it's valid. Like there's not a reason to compare offerings between all the different providers, because I think at the end of the day, the experience is very similar between all of them. The cloud is a commodity. I tell the people this all the time. Like, if you're looking for a VM, here's all the different VM offerings. You're looking for a container offering, here's all the container offerings, right? The real differentiator between all the clouds is how good the developer tooling is. And I think AWS has great developer tooling. And we should be looking at opportunities to show them for folks. That's part of the reasons why I was so interested when I joined AWS, is like, look, this is kind of an area that is untapped. There's lots of opportunity to talk with folks that aren't aware of these things. And if we can make their, you know, make their lives a little bit easier or a little bit simpler, or make their company, you know, their company's experience a little bit better, like, that's ideal, right? I'm enjoying it a lot. Like, having conversation with folks that don't know anything about AWS is very interesting, because I didn't have a lot of experience with AWS. But now it's like, I show people demos and they're like, oh, that doesn't seem too hard. I'm like, no, it's not hard. It's just you weren't aware of it. It's an awareness thing.
Yeah, it's kind of everything's complicated until you know it, and then things become simple.
This is very true, yeah.
Yeah. When you mentioned you had done a talk somewhere else recently on .NET on AWS, was that recorded? Because if it was, I can include it in the show notes.
Yeah, so it was at .NET Southwest. So I did a talk on, I think the name of the talk is .NET AWS Choose Your Own Adventure. And it basically just talks about all the different ways that you can host apps in AWS, right? Like, if you want flexibility and control, and you want to be able to manage the entire experience, there's VM offerings, there's a few VM offerings, there's managed services offerings, there's a whole slew of container-based offerings, there's serverless offerings, where if you just have a chunk of code and you want to run it. And I think showing just plainly, like, look at all these things, like, a lot of people are like, oh, okay. Like, I literally thought, like, Amazon and AWS is just VMs. Like, literally, because, look, EC2 is very, very popular because it's been around the longest. But there's all these different offerings that exist that folks can really get some great experiences from.
Any of the listeners that have listened to this podcast for a while are going to be able to guess my next question. Kubernetes offerings. That's a knowing question, but...
Yeah. Well, just like in every cloud provider, there's a managed Kubernetes offering in AWS called EKS, Elastic Kubernetes Service. What's interesting about EKS is that you have the opportunity to run it the way you want, right? Like, you can obviously do your own managed Kubernetes and you can do all that work yourself. Or you can use with something called AWS Fargate, which is kind of like an orchestrator for Kubernetes. I'll make sure we put a link in the show notes, but like the idea that you have managed Kubernetes, but then you have another thing that helps out with the managing of your nodes, managing of your pods, managing of all these other concepts in Kubernetes, and you run it in a somewhat serverless way, which is pretty cool. I think, and to be in general about containers and microservices, is that depending on what your, I guess, comfort level from a control standpoint, like, we have offerings from you have a lot of the control yourself to we have something called AWS App Runner, which is basically like, hey, I pointed at a GitHub repo, or I pointed at a image file, a Docker image file, or a container image file, and it just does everything else for you. It spins up the container, it manages the container, it manages all the resources for the container, and you don't need to know any container infrastructure concepts. It just does it all for you. And it gives you CloudWatch, which is kind of like our monitor tool inside of AWS. You have logs available for you right there. You can configure scale right there inside of the tool. And it's like completely turnkey. Like, I do a demo of this where it's like, hey, I have a command line tool. I run .NET deploy and I choose App Runner and it just does everything for me. Takes the code, containerizes it for me, so it creates a Docker image without me having to do it myself, and it just publishes it up to App Runner. So again, like, if people aren't aware of a tool like that and they see it, they are immediately like, oh, wow, like, it does everything. It even containerizes my app for me, which is pretty crazy to think about. Again, it's just about bringing value in interesting ways to folks.
Yeah, definitely. So this is a bit of a tangent, but it made me think when you were saying about automatically containerizing stuff. Have you seen the new .NET 7 thing? I think Nick Chapsas has recently done a video on it as well, but how without using a Docker file, it can .NET publish or build or whatever can just output to a container.
Yeah.
Everything's going that way, isn't it? Containers.
I think that there's one thing, and I've been thinking about this a lot recently, because especially with the .NET 7 announcement that, you know, container support inside the .NET SDK, I think that there is maybe some concern about Docker having a bit too much control over the container space. And there's other containerization technologies. Like there's Podman, there's Containerd, or Containerd. I don't know how it's actually pronounced. I apologize. People in your show note, in your comments will be like, oh, you said it wrong. But I mean, if you have like an OCI, like an open container spec compatible image file, it doesn't matter if you're using Docker or something else. So the ability to build a container without having a dependency on Docker, I think is very interesting. Because I think the last thing that everybody wants is for one technology to kind of rule them all. We kind of have that a little bit in the container orchestration space. Even though there are things like Docker Swarm and there's other tools, like Kubernetes has kind of taken the mantle. And I think with Docker, for instance, I think the last thing that we want is to kind of be locked into one technology. Because when you're locked into one technology, you become hyper-dependent on it, and that's not good for your business. So being able to do things that are container platform agnostic is very, very interesting. So, I mean, I went off on a bit of tangent there too, but like the idea that, you know, now you can literally create a container from the .NET CLI without having Docker installed, like is pretty interesting, right? I mean, it'll be interesting to see like what the next step is. Like, because I think this is obviously the first step into something else. So it'll be interesting to see what those next steps are.
I didn't actually realize that. I didn't realize that. I kind of assumed that when you did that .NET build command, it was using Docker under the hood and creating a Docker file you didn't see. I didn't realize you didn't have to have Docker installed.
Yeah, no, I mean, so it supports like Podman, for instance. So Podman is a containerization technology that's not Docker, right? So I think it's a agnostic way to publish and build and deploy containers, which is kind of interesting because I think when I talk about containers in general with folks, when I speak at events, like people don't understand that Docker is just one way to do containers. They think it's the way. And like, that's great for Docker, but it's not great for everybody else.
Yeah. I guess on the other side of that, where the .NET SDK or CLI is outputting containers and you're not using Docker files, one kind of, I don't want to say problem, but it feels like it encourages people not to understand or learn how it works in general, like with the whole, I know I'm going to like talk about Docker now, but with the Docker file where you've got the layers and you can add other commands and just how a Docker file works. And it feels like if that's being automated, so people just very rarely have to use that Docker file, are people just going to like not actually understand containers and layers and that kind of thing?
Yeah. I think the biggest, I guess, wrinkle to all of this is that there is a file that has the word Docker in it.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't have to be called Dockerfile, right? It's called Dockerfile because it's created by Docker and it's used by Docker. But all the, like, Docker files are all open container initiative spec files that allow you to define a container. So like Podman supports OCI, container supports OCI. It's just that because Docker has such a large market share and the file name is Dockerfile, people immediately assume like, okay, that's the only way that you can do containers. So it is very interesting. And I'm guessing that at some point in time, that's going to be demystified. I don't know when, but I think the worst thing that we can do is not look at other options for things. And maybe this goes into kind of a holistic idea that I have when it comes to .NET on AWS, for instance, right? Like, we're only doing ourselves a disservice by not looking at all of our options. So, you know, whether that's where you host your .NET apps or how you containerize your .NET apps, make sure that you're understanding like what the pros and cons are for each of the options and don't just choose the one that is the most quote unquote popular.
I think the thing is this goes back to our conversation about being passionate about this stuff. there's so many cool toys to play with.
Yes.
I just love it. All these different things. And where I said before that I've not really done anything with AWS, that's a bit bad, really. And I'm going to watch that video if it was recorded of your talk and have a play, because I've done an awful lot in Azure, and it feels like I'm doing myself a disservice to just do that without actually knowing its major competitor or one of its major competitors.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's interesting. Like, I mean, I was a similar way, right? Like, before I joined AWS, like, I worked at Microsoft. I had a bunch of Azure certifications. I talked about Azure at events. Like, but now, like, I see things a bit differently, because now, like, I have a good amount of experience in a different way of doing things. And I think if you're working at a company and all of a sudden your company makes a shift, it's like, oh, we're going to start putting applications on Azure or applications on AWS or whatever, right? And you don't have knowledge in that space. What do? You have two options, right? You can either vote with your feet, you can leave, because, I don't want to learn this new technology. I want to be Azure or AWS forever. I don't want to learn this new cloud. I'm going to leave and go to a different company. Or you can learn. And I think the only thing that you lose in staying and learning, you lose this opinion that there's only one way to do things. Because I think in tech, and this doesn't go from just cloud providers too, this goes for technologies, they're all commodities. Like, if you were to explain Node.js or Python or .NET or Java or whatever, like, they all solve the same purpose. They're just opinionated ways to do things. So, and this is kind of where I was having a conversation with somebody the other day about how we kind of get into these religious conversations about, like, our technologies, like the technologies that we care about. Like, I'm very guilty of it. I love .NET. I've tried to learn Go 40 times. I can't learn Go because it's not .NET. But I think that we have an opportunity as technologists to be a bit more open-minded about things. And that's only going to positively benefit ourselves, our businesses, the tech community at large, right? Because I think the last thing that anybody wants is there to be, like, one choice. And I know this is getting a bit preachy, so I apologize. But I think that the biggest thing from here is, like, what is stopping you? If it's interest, that's cool. But if it's, I just didn't have the time, I think there's always time to learn new things, at least me personally.
A topic I'm quite fascinated about is mindset. And it really comes down to that, really, because your example before where you said, if you've got to learn something new, do you leave or do you learn it? And this mindset thing applies to so many different things. You can either say, oh, I've got to learn this thing. Or I can be like, yes, I'm going to learn this thing to learn. I'm excited. I've got a new toy to play with. And other things, like if you're debugging, if you hit a bug and something's not working, it's like, oh, I've got to work out how to solve this problem. It's just a nightmare. I just want to get on with stuff. Or you can be like, oh, I've got a problem to solve. I'm going to crack this. And there's just so many different things. Even like playing with, like, I've got two kids. And sometimes it can be, I don't know, it's like, I've got something to do and they want to play. And it's like, go away, I'm doing this. When actually changing the mindset and thinking how lucky I am and just enjoying the moment and spending that time. I think it's just this mindset thing just applies to so many different things. And if you can actually switch your mindset, and if you intend to do that to lots of different things you do, your life can be so much better.
It's funny that you say the word mindset and you mentioned kids specifically. Like, my kid at some point at school heard the phrase growth mindset. And the way they interpret a growth mindset is, if you are negative about something, you lack a growth mindset. So, like, I'll say something, like I mentioned, I'm a kind of a pessimist, and, you know, something will come up and I'll be like, oh, I don't want to do this, whatever. And my kid will go, Dad, you need a growth mindset. You have a closed mindset right now. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, like, I can't function in this space. Like, you're too eager to try new things. But I think, yeah, it's funny. Growth mindset is totally spot on. Like, I think we're all very guilty of, like, being very, and I think this is a sociological thing with human beings. Like, we fear change. At our primitive level, we really fear change or things that are different. And the folks that are able to combat that and have that growth mindset, like you're talking about, like, those are the ones that end up getting more out of the experience. If you are born, you grow up, and then eventually you die and you don't really think about new ways to do things, like, I don't want to say it's a life wasted, but there's an opportunity wasted, right? So all I can do is try to be more open for things. That's why I interview people that I never would never talk to on my podcast. That's why I try to learn new technologies. Whether I'm successful at that is a whole different story. But I think there's an opportunity for all of us to think about things and see, like, okay, like, if I learn this new thing, like, what's the worst that can happen? The worst that can happen is I hate it and I just learn I don't like it and I just move on to something else, right? But the positive, or what could be good that happens, I fall in love with this new tech. Like, take my Go example. Let's say I learn Go because I've heard that I need to learn Go and I'm curious about it and I love it. I love it more than I love .NET. Like, what happens then? Now I have this whole new community of people that I can learn from, all this other content that I can consume to bring myself joy. No one is losing in that experience, right? That's what it is in a nutshell. And technology comes and goes, right? Like, we have the ability to change our tastes as it pertains to technology, right?
I think that's it. It's kind of, you mentioned about Go. A few episodes ago, I had a guest on, Joseph Woodward, and we're talking about Go, yeah. Actually. And he's an ex.NET developer, and he's now moved over to Go. And he changed companies, working with a company that did Go, and he now loves it. And that entire company used Vim. We had another episode on Vim, actually. Yeah. And so he's really got into that. So he's seeing the whole, all these other echo chambers of like Vim users, and there's a massive community there, and then Go and all that kind of thing. I've used Vim for quite a long time. Well, the Vim way of editing, but I'm now playing around with Vim the editor, which I've not used in a long time. And I'm kind of like enjoying like seeing like other echo chambers with that as well.
Yeah, it is fun.
It did make me laugh, your story about your kid and the growth mindset. It reminded me of one story of my kid. When I started the podcast, I was trying to stop myself from saying all the time.
Sure.
Because when I was listening back and editing, I realized I said it a lot. So I said to my kids, I know we don't normally condone interrupting, but if you hear me say interrupt me, just say don't say or anything. Both kids did it for a bit, but my youngest like carried on and took it to the extreme. Every time I mentioned it at all, it was like, he was spot on. It was like, don't say And it was brilliant because it really, really helped. But it's kind of, it's funny how they like, yeah, kids are brilliant, aren't they?
I've realized that if you give a kid a task and the kid gets any enjoyment out of it, they will run that task to the ground till it's exhausting, right? And I mean, I was there as a young child. Like, I remember doing things all the time that were probably super annoying to my parents. But I mean, yeah, it's funny that you mentioned like that you have, you say and what and different filler words. So I'm from Washington State. In Washington State, we use the word so a lot. And I try really hard not to say the word so. But what I've realized is that whenever I start a sentence, 95% of the time, the first word in that sentence is so. Because I guess in my brain, it's a transition into saying something. So I will say something like, so I'll say something like, right? Instead of me just saying, I'll say something. It's very strange. And I catch myself doing it, but I've tried many times. I've just kind of given up on trying to stop that. It's funny, like filler words are something that, I don't know if they're harmful, but they are completely distracting if you're aware of yourself doing them.
Yeah, I think one thing, because I know when I'm editing, I'm listening out for them, so I can chop them out as I'm editing, then I've kind of like conditioned myself to overly hear it. So in everyday conversations, I'm just hearing it all the time, and it's kind of like, I never realized before doing this how many filler words there are. And it's not just or so, it's you knows, I means, and even things like, I didn't realize how often myself and just in general, people say the first few words of a sentence and then start the sentence again in a slightly different way or the same way. And I didn't realize how frequent that was until I started intentionally listening during editing. And it's quite fascinating, really. I learned an awful lot about the way I speak myself.
Here's a question for you that I'd be curious. When you talk to people that are have different backgrounds or from different parts of the world, have you kind of picked up on different things that people from the UK do more than other people or people from the States do? Have you kind of picked up on those things. So like you, for instance, you're interviewing somebody from the States today. Okay, well, these are probably some of the things that they're going to do. Like these are the filler words they use. These are the nuances they have in the way they speak. Have you picked up on some of those things that after you've interviewed 50 people almost?
I guess for guests that maybe aren't native English speakers, they probably do them less.
Sure.
Because they've learned the language, so it's less just as you've grown up, you pick up various slangs and habits. So that's kind of easier in a way. You mentioned about you using the word so. I've not heard that during this conversation at all. In fact, to be honest, this is probably going to be one of the easiest episodes to edit because you're not on me an hour at all. So thank you for making this so easy.
We'll see.
Hi all. Isaac and I ended up having a very short break. When we got back, we started talking about back problems, and there wasn't really a smooth transition during editing to jump straight into that conversation, hence me leading into it now. If you're not interested in listening to us talk about our various disc issues, then skip forward about 5 minutes. No, it's all good. It was just dinner's ready, but it's in the oven, so it'll stay warm, so it's fine.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm keeping you from eating. Oh my goodness. I don't know about all that.
Talking about mindsets before, it's kind of, if later I'm more hungry because I've waited longer, then I'll enjoy it more.
That's true. That's true. Nothing is better than eating when you're hungry, I will say that. Nothing is better.
Well, I think nowadays I'm never hungry because working from home, especially the kitchen's just there. So it's kind of, it's a treat when I'm hungry.
It's very true. Like, and I have horrible eating habits. And I think one of the things that I've recognized more is that working from home probably isn't ideal for somebody with really bad eating habits. Like I tend to snack a lot. Like I can, you know, I can eat a whole bag of chips or crisps. I can eat a whole bag, no problem. And feel disgusting afterwards. But at the time, it's like, oh, this is quite good. That's why I try to be very active. I try to exercise every day. Because if I didn't, I would probably be in a different shape, I guess you could say.
That's a nice way of saying it. I used to be active, but I've been having all sorts of back issues this
year. Oh, yeah.
So I think it's a surgery jobby, to be honest, before I'm back into exercise.
Oh, yeah. I herniated a disc in my back last summer. And it was, yeah, I still have issues, like over a year later. Like, it's not fun at all.
Yeah, I find it fascinating that until you have the issue and you start talking to people about it, that it's amazing how common it is, actually, isn't it?
Well, I was talking to a doctor, but so when I herniated a disc in my back, like, it was really bad. I couldn't walk around, whatever. And when I went to see the doctor and they diagnosed me, he said, "Congratulations! You've officially done the thing." I'm like, "What do you mean? Everybody hurts their back. Like at a particular age, like if you're in your mid 30s and on, the chances of you having back issues is almost 100%. Especially now that we all sit in chairs, we sit in cars. Like we haven't evolved from a human body standpoint to be able to accommodate sitting down with our hips in a constant state of contraction." So we're going to have back issues unless you have a job that involves you standing in a comfortable way or walking in a comfortable way constantly. I've never met anybody that stands comfortably all day long for their work. They might stand, but they're not doing things that are comfortable. So like, it's interesting because yeah, it's just the idea that like everybody's going to have a bad back, a bad lower back at some point in their life is kind of depressing, right?
Yeah, definitely. When you're younger and you see all the good posture posters and you're like, yeah, whatever, ignore them. And actually, it's when you get old, you think, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done. But I've similar, my two lower discs are both torn and herniated. Oh. And one of them's catching my L5 nerve root, which is causing all sorts of issues. One of them, which is weird, my hip, when it gets aggravated, my whole hips just twist and contort.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm kind of like hobbling over. I've got, you probably can see in the background, I've got a walking stick.
Oh, wow.
So it's kind of, yeah, I'm 44 and I've got a bloody walking stick. It's like, seriously.
Yeah, no. So I had hip surgery when I was 30.
Oh, wow.
Because I got a sports hernia. And the surgery in general, I define it to people. So they reattach my hip adductor, so the inside muscles in my hips, to my pelvis. And they pull down my abdominals and reattach those as well. That was part of the surgery. And like when I tell people like I had hip surgery, they're like, "How old are you? What, you had hip surgery?" I'm like, "Yeah, I just, it is what it is." I mean, the whole thing too with the lower back thing is that it'll never go away. It's like, you know, one of the things that I've tried to do a lot is do like mobility exercises, right? Like, you know, doing hip elongation stuff to basic, because it's all connected, right? Your back, your hips, your knees. And if one thing is out of sequence, like, you're just going to get hurt over and over and over again. They tell you this when you're like 20, but you don't listen. It's like, I can literally go run 10 miles right now and then eat a hamburger afterwards. But now it's like, you know, when you're in your mid 30s or your late 30s or your 40s, you're like, oh, I wish I would have paid attention at all to any of this.
Yeah, definitely. I must say this year, I'm learning so much about the anatomy of like what you're talking about, like all that psoas, QL. Like,
oh, yeah. And like, you also realize like the parts of your body that we injure the most, that stay injured the longest, the reason why is because they don't get good blood flow. Like the herniated disc thing. The reason why you hurt your back and it takes like a year for it to heal is because the discs get literally zero blood flow. So like, they have to like heal like the slowest possible way, which like if you hurt your bicep or you hurt your shoulder or whatever, right? Like it hurts. If it's not like a major injury, like the pain will go away in a week or so, right? But like some of these parts of your body, like you'll literally hurt the rest of your life because they don't get any blood flow. It's crazy.
I think also another thing which I'm kind of guilty of, which I'm trying to do more, is water. It's kind of like a lot of people dehydrated and the disc can get very dehydrated. Yep. So that might be one thing that's made my issue worse because I have coffee, but not much water. So I'm trying to have more now.
Yeah, the drinking the water every day thing is just hard because there's an outcome. Like if you drink a lot of water, you got to go to the bathroom a lot. Your brain only tells you to drink water when you're thirsty, right? I wish there was something in your brain, because I don't like apps that tell you to drink water. I find them quite annoying. But like there's something in your brain that's like, oh, like you're 75% of water. Tap that up, right? Similar to like being hungry. Like I'm hungry constantly. And that's just because I have bad eating habits, so I eat all the time. But like, it would be great if my body was like, you should drink water instead of eat.
I also just don't get thirsty. I'm sure if I didn't drink for days, I would get thirsty. But in general, I don't. So I've got to be very intentional about it.
Sure.
So shall we move over to dev tips?
Yeah. Well, you went and checked in on stuff. I just looked at a couple and then I was like, oh, I'm just going to shamelessly plug something I've worked on. So we'll just do that.
Why not? Why not?
Yeah. Why not? Yeah, so I guess so. My developer pick or something that I think your listeners might be interested in is, so I built a tool called Presence Light. So what Presence Light does, it's a .NET application. It runs on your desktop. There's a web version as well, so it can run in containers and things like that. But what it does is it takes your Teams presence, so like whether you're available or away or busy in Microsoft Teams, and it broadcasts that status to different smart lights. So LifeX or Philips Hue or Yeelight. And basically the origin for this is that obviously during the pandemic, working from home, wanted my family to be aware of if I was busy or not. So I have a light outside of my office that changes color if I'm busy. So if it's green, you can come say hi. If it's red, leave me alone. If it's purple, which means do not disturb, it means like really leave me alone. Yeah, and it's been fun building that tool, and I've added some stuff to it. And right now I'm actually rewriting it to be in .NET MAUI, so it can run on phones and things like that. So yeah, that's something cool that I think folks might be interested in checking out. I'll provide a link so that you can put it. So it's available in like the Windows Store and Chocolaty and Winget and stuff like that, but it's also free and open source on GitHub as well.
That's something I really want, to be honest. I think it was a few months ago I tweeted out basically asking pretty much exactly that for the same use case.
Oh, cool.
So I'm definitely going to be looking at that. As you say, it's kind of like just being able to, and I like what you said then about the different levels of light. So it's like, really leave me alone versus, yeah, don't come in, but if you need to. I like that.
Yeah. And the way that I've written it is you can configure the color of light you want. It doesn't have to be green or purple or red. That's what the default is. But for instance, you know, Teams can detect whether or not you're presenting or you're away, but you're also not idle. So away and idle are two different things. So like you have a ton of flexibility as it pertains to like how you want the colors to be. So I also have this concept of working hours where it's like, okay, well, I want presence light to run and actually update lights during certain windows of the day if I want to. So yeah, it's pretty cool, and I've got a couple of diehard fans that love it. I think the last time I checked, I think there's like, I have like 300 to 400 active users of it, which is kind of cool. But yeah, it's just something to help make our lives simpler when we're working from home.
Does that link to recommended lights as well?
So the way I've written it is it supports a handful of branded lights because they have different APIs and stuff. I also created this idea of a custom endpoint. So for instance, if you have Home Assistant at your house, or if you have some other mechanism that you use to kind of manage your home automation, you can provide like a URL into it and configure it that way as well. So then like, okay, when I'm available, I want this particular endpoint hit. Maybe that does some other workflow or whatever. And I'm always interested if there are light recommendations for that people are interested in. I obviously can't buy every sort of smart light that exists, but if enough people are like, I would love to support this light, like maybe I'll spend the $15 on test on one bot. Or if you want to sponsor me on GitHub, you can, you know, throw me a couple bucks and I can buy the light myself, right? But yeah, so the ones that they have support for that are, I guess, branded lights are Philips Hue, Lifex, L-I-F-X, Yeelight, and Wiz, which are the four main ones.
Are these wireless, or would you need to like put a wire along?
No, so that's the whole point. So it's they're smart lights. So they're lights that have some sort of API, whether it's a SaaS service API where you have to make an API call out to some service, or one that runs locally in your intro network. Like Philips Hue, for instance, the Philips Hue lights have a bridge, which is a device that runs on your network that kind of intercepts traffic. So I send a request to the Philips Hue and that updates my lights accordingly. So yeah, some of them are requiring internet. Some of them don't require internet. I guess all of them require internet because you need to get the status from Microsoft Graph, which is the mechanism that I use to get the presence.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's more like, you can see my office, it's kind of where, yeah, I've got the door behind to actually have a light outside, mm-hmm, and trailing, yeah, cables and things. But if, yeah, it was a wireless, it's just a thing with an IP address on my network, then that's perfect.
Yeah, and I even have it one step up than that. So like I mentioned, you can run it like on Windows, for instance. But my personal implementation is I have a Raspberry Pi. I have a bunch of Raspberry Pis, but I have a Raspberry Pi that I have Presence Light running in a Docker container on that Raspberry Pi. So I have an endpoint, a URL that I go to in my own network, and then that spins up the UI for the app, and then I configure it there. So I don't have to have Presence Light running on my computer, and the lights are all wireless. So it's literally... There's a bunch of flexibility that you have with this tool. And I'm only looking to kind of make it more flexible. That's why Maui maybe add phone support and stuff like that. So it's kind of cool. I enjoy it.
Magic. I will definitely include a link to that in the show notes.
Sure.
So my dev tip is, I was watching some YouTube videos on NeoVim, because I mentioned earlier that I'm a Vim fan. And I noticed that the person doing it was, when they were moving up and down the code with the cursor keys, it was going much faster than my computer moves up and down. And not because it's Vim, it's just like the cursor keys. So I did a bit of Googling, and it turns out that by default in Windows and other OSs as well, as I believe, adds a repeat delay when you press the up and down arrow and you hold it down. It waits a bit before it actually then starts going down. So I changed the setting to remove that repeat delay, and just moving around the code base was just way faster. So I tweeted it out, and I can link in the show notes how to change it. But it just that little setting has made a big difference.
Interesting. And is that added solely to prevent people from typing in things too fast or hitting keys that mess up the interpreter? Like, what is the purpose for that? It seems to me like it's a safety feature, probably.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just, if you think about the typical OS user, isn't a power user using Vim, sure, or flying, yeah, around a code base. So it's kind of, I can understand the default, but it's useful to know that you can just change it and it makes a big difference to cursor speed.
That's great. I mean, I try to stay out of Vim because I end up getting stuck in it all the time.
The old ones are the best, aren't they?
Yeah. But no, I mean, that's cool. I think that a lot of people would be interested in that.
Yeah, I find Vim fascinating because we spoke about learning before. I've been using Vim, the key bindings, for like 20 years, 15, sure, 20 years. And I'm still learning key bindings. It's so powerful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's some different combinations and the ways you can do things. And two episodes back, as I mentioned, I had an episode with Joseph Woodward. So if any of the listeners are interested in Vim, we spent, I don't know, an hour geeking out on Vim, so it's worth a listen. Cool. So I am aware of the time. So before we do wrap up, where is the best place for listeners to reach out to you if they have any questions?
Yeah, I mean, I think the easiest way to find out what I'm doing is on Twitter at the moment. Who knows in the future, obviously. So, but I'm also on GitHub and Twitch. My handle there is IsaacR11, IsaacRLEVIN. That's the best way to probably find me if you want to follow along. Also, I have a podcast. We talked about a podcast a little bit, Coffee and Open Source. Yeah, I mean, if you're looking for me, you'll probably find me. I kind of hang out where all the tech people hang out. But yeah, definitely enjoy the conversation. And if anybody wants to learn more about what I'm doing in all aspects of things, I definitely would love to chat with you.
We'll include a link to all of like those social media places and your podcast and everything in the show notes as well.
Awesome.
Because I knew you were doing this, that's when I discovered your podcast. And as I said before, I listened to the Scott Hanselman one, but I'll definitely be subscribing and listening to more because it was a really interesting listen. So thank you.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate it.
And thank you for joining me here. This has been such a fun conversation. It's kind of, my timer says, after editing it, it'd be a little bit shorter, but 1 hour and 38 minutes. I love conversations where you just lose track of time. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. The only thing that I hope was from this conversation is that we both had a good time, and I definitely had a great time.
Definitely. Oh, I was going to mention the guitars in the background as well, which might make this even longer.
Yeah, for the people who, they can't see this, obviously, but yeah, I play guitar, not very well. My guitars are now art, but yeah, no, I have 2 Fender Stratocasters, and then I have a Martin acoustic guitar that I will play occasionally, not very well, though.
Do you find it with your podcast that it's amazing how many developers you speak to that actually play guitars or instruments and have things in the background?
Yeah, I have a tangent on this. Like, we can definitely have that conversation. I believe that there is a lot of connectivity between creative folk and technology. Like, I think there is this assumption that if you are more technical, you kind of have a more left side of brain approach where you're more analytical, mathematical, whatever. But I have the belief that technology is just right in the middle, because you need the analytical mind, you need the math or whatever, right? You need that problem-solving skills, but you also need to be very creative and need to be able to think outside the box to solve problems, because this is how I see things. If you try to follow the same process over and over and over again to solve different problems, you're going to have a hard time. So I think that there's a lot of people that play music, they draw, they use other fine arts, they sculpt. I know a lot of people that do stand-up comedy that are in technology. Like, I think it's just because that there is some that you say about there is more creativeness required to be a technologist than a lot of people probably are aware of. So yeah, I think like the summary to that is there is very interesting. Like, you'll talk to people in tech and they all play guitar. I don't know about like there. It seems to be guitar is the one that I see the most. But I know some other people that play piano or they sing or whatever, but guitar seems to be a thing. I also think in general, and this is probably not fair, but predominantly there's males in tech, and there's nothing really cooler to a guy than playing guitar. Like, it's whatever it is, I think that there's something to say that with that, right? Not to say that women can't play guitar or there's no women in tech, but even if somebody I talk to that doesn't play music, they always see my guitars behind me and they're like, oh, you play guitar? That's cool. And I'm like, yeah, I do play. And they're like, no, I just like guitars. I like looking at them. I'm like, okay. Everybody likes looking at guitars, I think.
Yeah, definitely. To touch on your point about gender as well, like, just off the top of my head, 2 guests I've had on, Jess White. Yeah. She had guitars in the background. Iris Klassen, she had guitars and we were geeking out guitars. So I don't think it's definitely a programmer thing. And I completely agree with your thing about creativity, because programming is art.
Yes.
You can't say like writing software and architecting the software isn't creative.
No.
I feel I need to move my guitar there because I've got like a Strat over there. In the other room, I've got a Mini Martin.
Oh.
I need them in camera.
Do you have the 3/4 Martin?
Yeah. The Ed Sheeran one.
Oh, that's... I gotta get that. Like, I've played it a few times. Like, I have small hands, so playing guitar is challenging sometimes. But I picked up the Ed Sheeran guitar when I was at Guitar Center or something. And I was like, oh, my hand feels massive on this guitar. So I need to definitely do that. I end up playing the electrics more because the neck is so much thinner. Like, I have a hard time playing the Martin because it's got a wider neck and, you know, I'm not the best guitarist ever. So like doing a lot of things that involve like weird hand shapes is kind of challenging sometimes. But yeah, I mean, there's something about guitar too that like you're allowed to kind of turn your brain off when you play an instrument, or you're, a different part of your brain is active. So I think there is something to say is like, oh, if you're a developer and you're working and you need to take a break, you can have a different part of your brain active. And then, at least from my experience, I don't know if you have a similar feeling where if you turn one part of your brain off to focus on something else, that part that you turned off, it's working still. So like there's been a couple of times where I'm not thinking about something in tech and I'm playing guitar. I'm like, oh, maybe I should try this. I got to put the guitar down and run back to the computer and see, right? So there is something to that as well, I think.
I find like with a guitar, when I'm learning something new, then it's like in code, I'm learning something new. It's kind of, it's hard work. You're working at it. But then once you've got the muscle memory of a song, something you've learned, then it becomes meditational. You can kind of like close your eyes and just play. And you change, what's the brainwave things? Like you change.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
It's a meditative state, isn't it?
Yeah. They call it the flow state, right? Like once you're in that flow, like the thing that I enjoy the most is going to like a concert and the musicians at a concert are just, they look like they're not even paying attention to the guitar they're playing. Like, because they've put in the 10,000 hours, they've mastered the instrument and they're having conversations with other bandmates while they're playing guitar. They're talking to people in the crowd. They're doing all this stuff. And like the guitar, even if it's really, you know, if there's really intricate movements, they're able to do it without any struggle. And like, I have so much envy for people that can do that. Like I said, I'm a very middling guitar player. So like whenever I see somebody who's mastered the instrument, it can do normal things while playing it and it doesn't affect their playing, I get very jealous.
Do you know how in software development they say that naming things is hard?
Sure.
Naming things enough by one of us. What are we going to call this episode? Because we've spoken about so many different things.
We can call it Naming Things is Hard. How about that?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe if I can pinch your podcast name, it can be like Coffee and Open Source. Would that work?
Yeah, if that's what you want to do. Or, you know, Ramblings of an Optimistic Pessimist. Or to go back, we were kind of talking a while ago about why I only put the person that I'm having the conversation with name. Because what ends up happening with my conversations on my podcast is we hit way too many topics. And that's something that I think that's a trait of mine. I like to talk about lots and lots of things. So I apologize that I've made this a bit challenging for you to figure that title, but I have faith you'll figure it out. There'll probably be like when you're listening back to this, you'll hear something you're like, oh, that's quite brilliant. Let's use that as a title. And I'm looking forward to what that title ends up being.
It's going to have coffee in the name because obviously that relates to your podcast, but
sure.
I like the idea of like coffee and a chat. So it's kind of, that's quite nice.
Yeah.
When this was quite a few episodes ago, I had Mark Rendell on and it was very similar where we just went in all sorts of directions and we had the conversation about what should we call it. And he had the suggestion of Mark Rendell's stream of consciousness, which was quite funny.
I've realized too, there's a handful of folks out. Like you mentioned Mark Rendell, I think of Mark Rendell too. Whenever I've heard him do an interview or even him talk, like it's just like he's brilliant. And I think that he needs to get everything out of his brain at once, which I relate to a little bit. I'm nowhere near as brilliant as Mark is, but it is quite fascinating that there are some people, like you mentioned, that are a bit more challenging to have a conversation with for a long stream of time, like an hour. And there are some people, like myself, who talk for 2 hours, right? It's like, it is interesting, like, you know, the different types of personalities that are in tech, too.
Yeah, definitely. Speaking of 2 hours, we are not that far off, so
sure.
We probably should wrap up. But yeah, thank you so much for joining us. It's been such great fun chatting with you.
No worries. Thank you, Dan. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Cool. And yeah, thank you, everyone, for listening. And a quick reminder that this podcast is sponsored by Everstack, which is my own company providing software development and consultation services. For more information, visit everstack.com. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please do help me spread the word on social media. I normally use the hashtag UnhandledException, and I can be found on Twitter at Dracan, which is DRACAN. My DMs are open. Now, actually, I'm on Mastodon as well, which is this new thing. So, and there's a link on the podcast website to all of these things anyway. And my blog, danclark.com, has links to all my social stuff too. And as usual, we'll include links to all the things we've mentioned today in the show notes, which can be found on Unhandled Exception Podcast.
www.thebrewingnetwork.com.